All right, so we're picking up in chapter 53, right? And we've come now to the pinnacle of the whole epistle. So we've seen him build this careful argument all the way for why these upstarts need to step down, why they need to get in line. And so he's going to shift gears a little bit and start giving them specific instructions on what to do next, now that he's made his full argument, specifically what the upstarts should do next. He says, "For you know and know well the sacred scriptures, dear friends, that you have searched into the oracles of God. We write these things, therefore, merely as a reminder." This is nice because it tells us that Clement assumes that his readers are biblically literate, which gives us a little snapshot of the first century believers. "When Moses went up to the mountain and had spent 40 days and 40 nights in fasting and humiliation, God said to him, 'Moses, Moses, go down quickly from here, for your people, whom you led out of Egypt, have broken the Torah. They have quickly turned away from the path which you established for them. They have cast for themselves some idols.'" All right, so we all know that story. Clement knows that his readers know that story. And he says, "And the Lord said to him, 'I have spoken to you time and again, saying, I have seen this people. They're stiff-necked indeed. Let me destroy them completely, and I will wipe out their name from under heaven, and I will make you into a great and wonderful nation, far more numerous than this one.' Moses said, 'May it not be so, Lord. Forgive this people their sin, or else wipe me also out of the book of the living.'" All right, so we all know that story. Clement knows that story. Clement knows that his readers know this story. Moses offers to exchange his life on behalf of the people. And Clement sees this as, of course, he sees the messianic capacity in this, that Moses is acting in a messianic capacity, interceding on behalf of the people. And so he's calling on his readers, and specifically the schismatics, the upstarts, he's calling on them to take on the same attitude, to demonstrate the same attitude. So he says, "What mighty love," and he's speaking of the love of Moses for the people of Israel, "what unsurpassable perfection. The servant speaks boldly with his master. He asks forgiveness for the multitude and demands that he himself also be wiped out with them." So this is Moses' ploy. This is how Moses brings about atonement on behalf of the people of Israel. He identifies himself with the people. It's the messianic reflex, I think. This is exactly how Yeshua also brought about redemption, by identifying himself completely with the people and suffering on behalf of the whole of the people. So that's chapter 53. So what's the point? Why is Clement bringing this up, this whole thing about Moses? And what does that have to do with anything? Well, he's going to make it clear now. He's going to say, "Now then, who among you is noble? Who is compassionate? Who is filled with love?" And of course, everybody's going to say, "Well, I am. I'm noble, compassionate, filled with love." So, "Who is filled with love? Let him say, 'If it is my fault that there are rebellion and strife and schisms, I retire.'" And here, retirement is not, it's not retirement from work, but retirement from your office. So, if I'm causing problems in the congregation, I should step down. In other words, if I'm causing disruption in the congregation, then I should step down. And this is what he's asking these upstarts who have assumed leadership. They've displaced the leadership and they've assumed leadership, and it's created this great uproar. We're not talking about, people arguing over the color of the carpet or something like this. We're talking about a great uproar that, in fact, has been heard about all over, and even among the non-believers, this great schism. So he says, you should retire rather than, if you're the cause of this. "This is the sacrifice you should make. Just like Moses was willing to be blotted out of the book of life for the sake of the people of Israel." He's saying, "Blot me out of your book for the sake of the people." You should be, at least, if Moses is willing to, like, be blotted out of eternal life, you should at least be willing to step down from your position. He says, if it's my fault, this is what you should say, if it's my fault that there are rebellion and strife and schisms, I retire. I resign. I quit. I will go wherever you wish. I will do whatever is ordered by the people. Only let the flock of the Messiah be at peace and with its duly appointed elders, its duly appointed leadership. The one who does this will win for himself great fame in the Messiah. This is what always frustrated me about our schismatics. You know, it's like, why not take this attitude? If you can't agree with the leadership, or you're upset about the direction the community is going, or whatever it is that's giving you all this angst that causes all this uproar, why not just sacrifice it for the sake of the peace of the body of Messiah and just say, okay, I'm going to step back and I'm just going to go my way. I'm not going to cause disruption. This is what Clement recommends. He says, the one who does this, who behaves like this, will win for himself great fame in Christ, and every place will receive him, for the earth is the Lord's and all that is in it. So it's like, that's the truth. If I'm unhappy with this community, if I was a congregant going here and I couldn't stand me, I mean the leadership, so I couldn't stand me, I'd have two choices. You know, it's like I have a big argument with the leadership. I'd have two choices. I could either make waves and do my best to bring about change and disruption and that sort of thing and create schism or I could just quietly, say, okay, this is just not for me, and go someplace else, which is exactly what Clement is saying. Just maybe you just go someplace else and then you'll be received someplace else. You'll be received well someplace else. But if you create this disruption, you're not going to be received well in the next place you go to. And we know, that's the case. You might be received well at first, but it's like there's this spirit that comes with you, this spirit of disruption. These are the things that those who live as citizens of the commonwealth of God, something not to be regretted, have done and will continue to do. So I like this language here. Those who live as citizens of the commonwealth of God. It's just another way of saying the kingdom of heaven, the commonwealth of God. But those who are already living as citizens of the messianic era, of the kingdom of heaven, this is how they behave. How do we know? Well, this comes directly from the teaching of Yeshua. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the merciful, the humble, this sort of thing. This is what characterizes a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. And Clement can contrast this. He doesn't, but he could. He could contrast this to a citizen of Rome. Olam Hazeh, this current world. Olam Hazeh is Rome in his day. And Olam Haba, of course, is the kingdom. So he could contrast it with Roman ambition, Roman pride, Roman dignity. Rome is like everything is built in that Roman world around defending the self this sort of this pompous approach to life. There's really no different today, except it seems a little bit more naked because when we read Roman literature and this sort of thing, it's like, the sentences never end. They just go on and on and on. But same idea. Not so the disciple of Yeshua, not so the citizen of the kingdom of heaven. We're supposed to be a totally different breed, totally different breed of human being. So that's chapter 54, calling it Sacrifice for Peace. All right, so chapter 55, Clement gives us more examples. He already gave us the example of Moses. In the previous chapters, he gave us the example of Moses, who was willing to sacrifice himself and his place in the world to come on behalf of his people, which is very similar to what Paul says. I was just reading in Paul, I think in Romans 9, when he makes almost the exact same statement. He says, I have undying sorrow in my heart on behalf of the people of Israel. I would gladly, wish myself accursed, condemned. If I could trade places. Anyway, so he's already given us this example of Moses. And then he goes on now to give us some more examples. And I like how he begins. He says, let us moreover bring forward some examples of Gentiles as well. Now, of course, Clement realizes that he's writing to Gentiles, that a lot of the Corinthian believers are Gentiles. But when he uses Gentiles in this sense, he's not making a distinction in that regard of Gentiles versus Jews, but rather he's just speaking broadly of ethnos, of the nations, the pagans, the non-believers, the idolaters even. So, for example, he says, in times of pestilence, many kings and rulers, being prompted by some oracle, some oracle from the gods, have given themselves over to death that they might rescue their subjects through their own blood. Now, if I wasn't so lazy, I would have looked up some stories, that we could have looked at together and said, okay, let's read the story of this guy, Agamemnon, something like this, Let's read the story of, what's the guy who falls in love with his mother, or that story. These Greek stories, these Greek and Roman stories, they always have the same thing. There's a terrible plague, and then you find out, it's the leader's fault, and then he has to atone for the transgression. And so what does he do? He sacrifices his life. So Clement's appealing here actually to pagan literature. I say, okay, let's set aside the biblical examples for a second. I mean, just even the Gentiles, even the godless, even the idolaters understand sacrifice for the sake of the common good. And that's true. That was a big ethic of the Roman world, was sacrifice for the sake of the common good. That you set aside your prerogatives for the sake of the society. He goes on to say, many have left their own cities that there might be no more rebellions. I'm sure that's true. And we know that many among us, so now he's no longer speaking of these pagans, of these idolaters, these ethnos, but he's speaking of believers. And this is some very powerful words here that give us a little glimpse into the first century. He says, we know that many among us have had themselves imprisoned that they might ransom others. And this is a surprise to me when I was preparing for tonight's notes. I thought, really? So you could go, if there was somebody who was imprisoned, you could go and say, hey, I'll trade places with so-and-so, arrest me, and let that person go. But then I thought about it, and it's like, yeah, that does make sense. I think Roman law would work that way. Now, I haven't looked it up or anything like that. But I know of lots of situations where, for example, King Herod, his sons were raised in the court of Caesar. It's a big honor, to be in the court of Caesar. It's like they were homeschooled in Caesar's palace. But why is this? Well, it's because King Herod was a client king. And as long as his sons were in Rome, Caesar Augustus knew that Herod would not revolt against him because he had his sons hostage. And so it wasn't just Herod. This is the way that the Romans worked with all their client kings. They took their children to educate them, quote unquote, in Rome. And they did give them great educations. But there was also the knowledge that if you revolt against us, we will kill your children. So I think this could work on the same principle. Now, Clement's referring to the Domitian persecution, where people were, we learned about that earlier in the class, where the emperor learned about believers for the first time. He learned that there's all these Gentiles who have wandered into Jewish ways. So he's arresting them. He's arresting them left and right. But apparently, among the believers in Rome, there were some who would volunteer to go stand in for those who had been arrested and say, you know what? Arrest me. I will be, it's like bail, it's like paying bail, where you get arrested and then you put down bail that you won't run before your trial. And so what they're doing is they're saying, I will be the bail on this person, which is a, you know, that's a sacrificial gesture for sure. So he says, we know that many among us have themselves been imprisoned that they might ransom others, and many have sold themselves into slavery, and with the price received themselves, the price that they received for themselves, they have fed others. So if you became extremely destitute in the Roman world, you couldn't declare bankruptcy. You had to. There was only one recourse left for you, and that was to sell yourself as a slave. And say, hey, you know, and then you could, you know, your creditors, of course, could seize the value of your sale. In this case, what we see is that we see early believers, actually, who are clearly destitute. I mean, this is Paul tells people not to do this, not to become slaves. But it appears that we're looking at some people who have no other choice. They sold themselves into slavery, and with the price, they gave it to charity. The price of their that they got for themselves. They sold themselves. He goes on, many women, being strengthened by the grace of God, have performed many manly deeds. That's what it takes for a woman to perform a manly deed. She needs the grace of God, right? Well, so what is he talking about? Now he's no longer talking about Gentiles whatsoever, or even Christians, but he's talking about, he's going to give us some examples from Jewish history. For example, the Blessed Judith. You know Judith. You know the story of Judith. It's a Hanukkah story. We read it at Hanukkah. It's in the Apocrypha. It says, when the city was under siege, she asked the elders to permit herself to permit her to go into the enemy's camp. So she exposed herself to peril and went out for love of her country and of her besieged people, and the Lord delivered Holofernes into the hand of a woman. Right. So the story is, you know, with Judith. Judith is a widow. This beautiful widow, young widow. She lost her husband at a young age. Many suitors came and asked for her hand. She refused them all. Instead, she wanted to be one of these. She wanted to be a holy widow, praising God and just living for God, living alone. So she wore her widow's garments, her mourning garments, for years and years and years, until the city was under siege. And then when the city was under siege and Holofernes and his army gave the people the opportunity to surrender or die, she said, you know what, don't even discuss it with them. Instead, everybody should take a fast and pray. And as for me, I'm going to, with your permission, I would like to go out and deal with this general myself. And so she puts on her courting clothes, I guess, and goes out and brings some wine, cheese, and feeds the general, gets him thirsty, gets him drunk. He falls asleep before he's able to make his moves on her, and she cuts off his head, carries his head by his hair back to the city, and says, look, Hashem has delivered the city. So it's a great story. And the picture of Judith walking with the hairy head of Holofernes, you know, swinging this man's head by the hair is kind of etched into Jewish consciousness, I think, especially around the festival of Hanukkah. And he gives another example. To no less danger did Esther, who was perfect in faith, expose herself in order that she might deliver the 12 tribes of Israel when they were about to be destroyed. And we know the story of Esther. For through her fasting and her humiliation, she entered the all-seeing master, the God. She entreated, I read entered. She entreated the all-seeing master, the God of the ages, and he, seeing the humility of her soul, the affliction, she is afflicting her soul with fasting, he rescued the people for whose sake she had faced the danger, the Jewish people, in the story of Purim. So here we have a Purim story. We just had Hanukkah and Purim. This is great. We had Hanukkah and Purim in the same chapter. And what's the point of these examples of self-sacrifice? Again, remember, he's asking these people to show the same spirit, these rabble-rousers, these rebels, he's asking them to show the same spirit of self-sacrifice and to step aside in the name of peace.